close-up look at last week's federal budget.
Money for parents isn't a bad thing. How they're doing it is different. We gave the whole family benefit package a B grade as a result.
When Pierre-Éliott Trudeau ran the first deficit in a string of almost 30 consecutive years back in 1970-71, I'm sure it wasn't his intention to begin that type of consecutive deficit spending.
It's our kids and grandkids that are going to be the ones who are going to be faced with huge taxes that are going to have to be put in place in order to pay those things back, and it's just not right.
In the news, a shocking new reality on doctor-assisted suicide. Doctors are being told it's okay to lie when they make out death certificates. A coalition of disability groups has crafted a standard to protect vulnerable persons from physician-assisted death. A formal new petition on Cassie and Molly's law. And social conservatives have lost a major ally in Parliament.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
There's a new twist to the notion of doctor-assisted suicide in Canada. A judge in Ontario has agreed to a request from an 81-year-old man that his doctor be allowed to kill him. It wasn't the first time a judge has allowed for physician-assisted death as we await new federal laws on this, and the Supreme Court did expressly allow for judicial orders like this until that new law is written. But what was new about this ruling was that the judge also agreed to the man's request that instead of stating on his death certificate that he died from a lethal injection by a doctor, the doctor could simply write that he died from the disease that was ailing him, changing the death certificate. Alex Schadenberg from the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition says this is already allowed in several other jurisdictions, but it's a very, very slippery slope for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the impact it'll have on medical research and record-keeping generally.
We don't know, then, the timing of death. We don't know the prognosis of a disease. All these sort of issues, which can be researched by looking at death certificates and by looking at medical records, all start becoming falsified and incapable of bringing us proper information. But the biggest thing to me at all is that everything starts to be based on a lie. In the past, someone could lose their medical license over lying on a death certificate. And now they're saying, you must falsify the death certificate. To me, it is far too important a question in order to tell doctors that not only are you going to be killing people, but you're also going to be falsifying death certificates.
And Schadenberg says there's also an underlying issue here. He says the justification for falsifying death certificates doesn't match up with everything else we're being told about euthanasia.
The whole reason for this is based on privacy, that the person after they die should not be known as dying by euthanasia or assisted suicide. But if there's nothing wrong with assisted suicide or euthanasia, then why would you be concerned about this? Why would you have to lie on a death certificate? The argument is that there's nothing wrong with this. Either there's nothing wrong with this and we can be upfront about it, or there is something wrong with it and we require silence.
Also on the physician-assisted death front, a group of disability advocates has stepped up with a suggested set of safeguards to protect vulnerable persons from euthanasia. It's called the Vulnerable Persons Standard. There's five main points. First of all, vulnerable people, defined as those with severe disabilities, mental illness and dementia, or seniors living in long-term care, need equal protection in law. Also, they have to be suffering from a condition or disease that will end their lives with no chance of improvement. They have to be able to give competent and capable consent. Their suffering and vulnerability needs to be independently assessed and confirmed, and the death has to be authorized at arm's length, in other words, by a judge. Catherine Frazee is a former professor of disability studies at Ryerson University in Toronto. She was one of the contributors to the standard, and she says the unmet needs of patients should never be considered a justification for euthanasia. That includes both a lack of palliative care and a lack of social support.
Recent studies coming out of Europe of persons with psychiatric conditions who were assisted to die tell us that the majority of those persons identified loneliness as part of their despair. And loneliness is a social condition. It arises from social isolation. It is an expression of unmet need. And we can't let people pursue and receive an assisted death, either because they haven't been offered a good palliative care or had their social needs met.
We've got a link to the Vulnerable Person Standard webpage and a place where you can express your support for this idea from the Lighthouse News homepage this week. Several new developments in the Molly Matters case. That's the campaign out of Windsor, Ontario, to amend the criminal code to invoke special criminal sanctions against people convicted of injuring or killing a preborn child while committing an offense against the mother. Last week, MP Kathy Wagenthal's private members bill cleared the Subcommittee on Private Members' Business. This is the committee that determines whether a bill is actually votable in Parliament. You may recall that a few years ago, MP Mark Warrow's private member's bill on sex-selective abortion ran into a roadblock at this committee stage. But Wagenthal's bill has passed that stage now. That means it will come up for a first round of debate sometime in May. Further to that, there's also a new online petition in support of the law, and it has parliamentary sanction. We Need a Law's Mike Schutten says this is a new formal petition process to Parliament, using the internet.
This is the results of many years of work, actually, by an NDP MP, Kennedy Stewart from Burnaby Douglas. He has worked hard to get Parliament to accept electronic petitions. So as of December 2015, these became an acceptable way of petitioning the government. Now, the Molly Matters campaign have launched a petition. So we're promoting this to all our people, saying, look, we want as many signatures as possible.
If the petition gets 500 signatures, the issue automatically goes to Parliament for a debate. As we were producing this week's program, there were already 1,500 signatures on this particular petition. They could always use more, though. We've got a link up from the homepage. And one thing more, a very unexpected sudden death in Ottawa last week. Jim Hillier, the member of Parliament for Medicine Hat, Cardston, Warner in southern Alberta, was found dead in his office near Parliament Hill at 5 o'clock last Wednesday morning. He was just 41 years old. Cause of death thought to be a heart attack. There's a meme circulating on the internet that tells you a lot about Mr. Hillier. A quote on the abortion issue. Let me read it. I have declared wildly and boldly in my first nomination that I am pro-life, and that whenever a pro-life question comes up, I will vote pro-life. That was Jim Hillier. As I said, he was the MP for the Medicine Hat riding, basically the southeast corner of Alberta, but he'd recently switched constituencies. Before last year's election, he was the MP for Lethbridge. John Vorhorst is with the Southern Alberta chapter of ARPA.
There was a very good relationship with the Southern Alberta ARPA. He would always be very willing to meet with us. He was always very, very sympathetic to the causes that we would bring to his attention, and we really appreciated the work he did together with us and also any other social issues that we might bring to his attention.
Vorhorst says Hillier will definitely be hard to replace.
It's always difficult to build new relationships, so it will definitely put pressure on the social conservative element in the party. But, you know, one of the things that we know is God is in control and God will always continue to care for his people, and we need to continue to trust that, his ways are higher than our ways. And Southern Alberta ARPA has always been very comforted by that fact.
Hillier's passing prompted a delay in question period in the Commons last Wednesday so MPs could pay tribute. Interim Conservative leader Ronna Ambrose says Hillier was fulfilling a lifelong dream in his role as an MP, but she added he was also known for his sense of humor.
He took his job very seriously, and as I said, he had a goofy sense of humor. He had something funny he said in the media recently. He was from Southern Alberta, that says something about him, and he was asked about his views on Donald Trump, and he said, well, where I come from is redneck, and we're not that redneck.
When we come back, a comprehensive analysis of last week's federal budget.
Do you have a question about Canadian news or politics that you would like answered on air? We would love to hear from you. Go to arpacanada.ca/lighthousenews and click on Answering Machine to leave us a brief message. Please keep your message to 60 seconds or less. When leaving a message, please start with your name and where you're calling from. Visit arpacanada.ca/lighthousenews and tune in to hear answers to your questions and much more.
And we're back on the program. Last week, Justin Trudeau's government presented its maiden budget in the House of Commons. It was quite a shift from the kind of fiscal emphasis we'd seen from the Harper Conservatives in the past few years. The government is moving back into deficit financing in a big way. Before we get to the details of that, though, some specifics from the budget and how it'll affect your family. Andrea Morozik with the Family Research Arm at Cardis has looked at some of the numbers, and she says there's been a shift in the child tax credit system. Some of the so-called boutique tax credits are gone. On balance, the whole system's being rolled into a single payment for families, and it's based on income. From a policy perspective, she says, it's what the Liberals promised in the election, and it does have a positive side.
A benefit of universal child benefits is that it recognizes the family as an institution. It recognizes that all children are important, regardless of what families they find themselves situated in. The benefit of the targeted new benefit that we currently have, replacing the old benefit, is that it does address child poverty in a more significant way. And so there's a greater level of benefits going to people below a certain income level.
She also says the budget really isn't as bad as it could have been.
On the child and family front exclusively, things could have been a lot worse. We could have seen something like an NDP-style national daycare system come through. What you end up with then is a very poor system that nobody can afford not to use, because you've just taken all of your monies and put them into one system. Regardless of what kind of care parents want, that's what they would be then compelled in a certain sense to use. So I'm grateful that they don't have that commitment, and I'm grateful that the money is taxpayer dollars going to parents. That's a conservative principle, small c, and as it happens under the conservative government, it was also something they put into practice. Money for parents isn't a bad thing. How they're doing it is different. We gave the whole family benefit package a B grade as a result.
But what about the broader context? Cardis's executive director, Ray Penning, says while the government kept its main election promise about focusing on infrastructure and the middle class, keeping those promises came with a huge price tag.
The Liberals on the campaign promised a $10 billion deficit per year, maintaining the debt-to-GDP ratio, and returning to balance before the next election. This budget indicates that all three of those objectives will be missed, and over $114 billion of deficit spending will take place during the course of this budget.
Some agreement on that from Sean Spear. He's a budget analyst at the McDonald Laurier Institute.
New investments in the area of infrastructure and early childhood learning in indigenous communities is a long time coming and the type of thing that the government ought to be doing. But the problem is the fact that the government is not just returning deficit, which it promised to do in the recent election campaign. It's returning a deficit with real gusto. We'll see deficits that are three times larger than the government promised, and more worryingly, no return to balanced budget over the horizon.
Spear says we have seen this kind of thinking in federal budgeting before, and that didn't end well.
When Pierre Trudeau ran the first deficit in a string of almost 30 consecutive years back in 1970-71, I'm sure it wasn't his intention to begin that type of consecutive deficit spending. But it's what happened, because once you turn the taps on, it's hard to turn them off. And protracted deficit spending leads to more and more debt. And so the government says interest rates are low and now's the time to borrow. And that may be true in some sense. But as I say, once those taps go on, it's hard to turn them off. And before too long, we're facing a crisis like we did in the 1990s.
Bottom line, ARPA policy analyst Colin Postma says it's easy for governments elected for only short four-year terms to put themselves into deficit, but it's not fair to future generations.
It's very easy for them to make lots of promises and just to spend with the credit card, because ultimately it's not on them. In the next election even, we won't necessarily see the repercussions of such a large deficit like that. But it's down the road that that's really going to be impacting us. I saw this video online the other day that really put it in clear picture for me, and that was basically a fellow going to the bank, and he wanted to buy a new truck, but his finances were such that the bank kept denying him. But they allowed him to take out the loan when he brought his kid in and had his kid sign for him. And I thought that's exactly the kind of situation we're looking at here, is that we're spending this money on the backs of our kids. And it's my generation, the generation below me, you know, our kids and grandkids, that are going to be the ones who are going to be faced with huge taxes that are going to have to be put in place in order to pay those things back. And it's just not right.
If you're interested in more research or reaction on the budget, we link to some online reaction pieces from Cardis, the McDonald Laurier Institute, and several top financial and political columnists. The link's on our homepage this week.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpacanada.ca.
Be sure to join us again next month for another edition of Lighthouse News.